Dr. Our pleasure, independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vetari and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran slams Israel's outrageous allegations against Tehran, saying such remarks are aimed at deflecting attention from the regime's atrocities in the region. Tunisia's president receives the draft of the new constitution that increases his powers less than a month before a referendum on the document. Also, Russia's former president dismisses nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. as pointless, saying Moscow should wait until the Americans beg for negotiations. Good to have you with us. Iran slams Israel's, quote, outrageous allegations against the country, saying the regime wants to deflect attention from its atrocities in the region. Iran's UN ambassador says Israel is infamous for its racist policies and hate speech and cannot hide this fact through propaganda. Majid Takhravanchi was responding to anti-Iran allegations by Israel's representative at a UN meeting marking the first International Day for Countering Hate Speech. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian envoy warned against the growing trend of Islamophobia, saying such tendencies lead to violent extremism and threaten the security of all societies. He cited the politicization and restriction of the hijab, the burning of the Holy Quran, and the desecration of Islamic symbols and holy sites in some countries. Takhravanchi blamed the situation on anti-Muslim media outlets and civic groups promoting Islamophobia in the West. He also lamented the lack of resolve on the part of certain governments to confront hate speech and acts of hate against Muslims. The leaders of Israel's fragile coalition cabinet are set to submit a bill to dissolve the parliament, paving the way for the fifth general elections in 3 years. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and his foreign minister Yair Lapid made the announcement in a Monday statement. The regime's top officials admitted that the decision came after all options to keep the coalition cabinet failed. The bill, which will be submitted next week, will make Bennett the regime's shortest-serving premier. Lapid will take over as the interim premier until the next election, which is scheduled for October 25th. Israel's fragile eight-party coalition was formed in June 2021 after four successive inconclusive elections. It lost its majority in Israel's parliament in April, when a member of Bennett's Yamina party announced her departure. Yemenis are still suffering from the consequences of the Saudi-led war, despite the UN truce entering its third month. The Latif al-Washili has the story.
Amid a decline in military operations since the UN ceasefire took effect in April, the number of victims of banned weapons in Yemen keeps rising. Remnants of Saudi cluster bombs are taking more lives as Riyadh refuses to allow badly needed equipment, including mine detectors, to enter the war-torn country. Yemen's Mine Action Center reported 120 cases since the start of the truce, 26 of them in the first third of June.
Since the beginning of this year, 326 people have fallen victim to leftover cluster bombs. 120 of them alone have been killed since the start of the truce. The bombings of the Saudi-led coalition continue to claim the lives of innocent citizens on a daily basis. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has been preventing the entry of necessary equipment for years, even though our work is for humanitarian purposes. Therefore, we believe that the coalition seeks to kill civilians even after the end of the war.
The Mine Action Center says the Saudi-led coalition has prevented the entry of mine detectors to Sana'a since 2018 for no good reason, and field teams are still working despite all the risks.
The biggest problem that the center faces is the lack of mine detectors and field equipment. We have been facing this problem since the outset, and unfortunately, the devices and personal protection equipment were not provided even throughout the years of war. In 2018, the United Nations informed us that our equipment had arrived in Djibouti. But much to our surprise, part of it was held by the Saudi-led coalition and some was handed over to other parties not affiliated with us, and we have not received anything until this moment.
During the seven-year war, the Saudi-led coalition has used 15 types of internationally prohibited cluster bombs in its attacks against residential areas across Yemen. However, officials say relevant international organizations refrain from cooperating for political reasons. People here are dying due to the remnants of internationally banned weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition. Experts believe the number of victims will continue to rise unless the coalition allows the needed equipment to defuse the weapons that kill Yemeni women and the children to enter Yemen. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
Tunisia's president has received a draft of the new constitution that would increase his powers less than a month before a referendum on the document. After receiving the draft on Monday, President Kais Saied said some chapters needed amendments. Saied has until June 30th to approve or edit the draft, which has not yet been disclosed to the public. He intends to put the new constitution to a referendum on July 25th. The opposition has said it will boycott the plebiscite, while thousands of Tunisians protested against the referendum over the weekend. The president has already appointed a new electoral commission, casting doubts on the credibility of any vote. He has also appointed a temporary judicial council and sacked dozens of judges. Saied seized the executive power last year, dissolving the parliament and ruling by decree in a move described by his opponents as a coup. A top Russian official says holding nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. is pointless, suggesting that Moscow should wait until Americans come forth and beg for negotiations. Former president and current deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, believes there is no need to negotiate nuclear disarmament with the U.S. yet, because it's bad for Russia. Medvedev says Washington and Moscow do not have any relations now, and therefore everything is, in his own words, a dead zone. As Russia's president, Medvedev signed the New START Treaty in 2010 with then-U.S. President Barack Obama. The treaty was extended in 2021 for 5 years. But fears of a renewed arms race are now on the rise amid critically sour relations over the war in Ukraine. Russia and the U.S. are the world's biggest nuclear powers. They control about 90% of the global atomic arsenal. The Kremlin says two Americans who were caught fighting Russian forces in Ukraine have committed crimes and will have to be punished for that. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the two were endangering Russian lives by firing at and shelling military personnel. According to Peskov, Russia cannot guarantee that they will not face the death penalty. He says the nature of their crimes will be investigated. These are the first official comments coming out of Moscow about the two Americans after the U.S. State Department said it had seen reports of their seizure. Both captives are reportedly U.S. military veterans. Earlier, a Russian-backed court sentenced two Britons to death for fighting as mercenaries alongside the Ukrainian army. Belgian police say tens of thousands of people took part in a march through Brussels on Monday demanding government measures to offset record high inflation. This is why the European Union comes under mounting pressure for spending billions of euros on arming Ukraine at a time when the bloc's citizens are struggling to make ends meet. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Tens of thousands of union members marched through Brussels city centre on Monday, calling for more support to deal with the cost of living, which is rising by the day. Inflation in Belgium has hit 9%. The Eurozone average is 8.1%.
The prices of electricity, water, all the supplies are going up, and the wages stays the same.
I have a bill to pay 6,000 euro for gas and electric. That's not normal.
All the other costs are very high. Energy, electricity, gas, but also food.
It's cheaper if I stay home than if I go and to work. That's not good.
The demonstration was organized to coincide with a national one-day strike.
Belgium has been brought to a standstill by this strike. Trains, trams, metros and buses are not operating. All of the departing flights from the main airports in Zaventem and Charleroi have been cancelled, impacting an enormous number of passengers, including would-be holidaymakers.
Western nations are sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro. Those on strike insist there is too much emphasis on war and not enough on diplomatic negotiations.
There is a NATO rule which says that each country has to invest 2% of their budget on military stuff. I think this is completely useless.
They have money to send to Ukraine for sophisticated weapons. It will cost a lot. And they say they don't have enough money to support us.
All of them, they just have blood on their hands. I think that's the real problem. And high society who is just making profit of all of that.
Unions in Belgium are warning of more strikes during the summer if the national government and EU authorities fail to ease cost of living pressures. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Barely 2 weeks ago, the British Prime Minister survived a potentially lethal challenge to his leadership. Boris Johnson narrowly made it through the Conservative MP's vote of no confidence in the House of Commons. And yet Johnson has decided to take on new challenges instead of talking about the Partygate scandal and his actions during the coronavirus pandemic.
Considering the latest controversies around Johnson, the British Prime Minister seems to be taking full advantage of a strategy known as the dead cat strategy in order to divert media attention away from problems or failures in other areas. Just a week after the vote of confidence, the British Prime Minister and his government are provoking other crises. Johnson says he wants to focus on what the people of the country want. And the first two issues which he has decided to tackle are the controversial matters of changing trade rules for Northern Ireland and flying refugees to Rwanda, both cases that thrust Britain into a nasty web of legal disputes that risk making the country look like an international scofflaw. With his leadership in peril, Johnson summoned his trusted advisors, and among those experts is political strategist Linton Crosby, a master of so-called wedge issues that divide national opinion. Such strategies are typically used to galvanize working-class voters. The most divisive wedge issue is asylum seekers, as Crosby clearly demonstrated in his experience with the Australian premiership, winning him many victories some 2 decades ago. So it wasn't a coincidence that a few days after their meeting, Home Secretary Priti Patel's floundering plan to export asylum seekers to Rwanda was revived. But at what cost has the British Prime Minister risked turning the UK into a pariah?
The controversy surrounding it is becoming more of a legal battle. We have seen the human rights, the European Court of Human Rights, intervening in the issue based on, you know, filing from some of those affected by the decision, some of the asylum seekers. And I wonder if the UK really became a pariah state under Mr. Johnson, because this is not the first time he is going against international law.
The chartered Boeing 767 booked to take asylum seekers to Rwanda was a fiasco. It didn't take off thanks to a last-minute intervention from the European Court of Human Rights.
The UK has in essence thrust itself against the European Court of Human Rights on Rwanda agreement, which stipulates that refugees to Britain will be deported to the African country and receive asylum procedures. The controversial £120 million or pound deal is coming under heavy criticism in regard to its legality.
The British government's first attempt of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda came to a halt on Tuesday after the European Court of Human Rights intervened and forced the UK to abandon the flight. The intervention has, however, drawn frustration from British ministers who insist the plan was lawful. Britain's failed attempt has also led to officials proposing alternatives that would allow the UK to ignore the ECHR. Johnson himself defended the plan, saying it was completely legal.
Every single court in this country said, you know, there was no obstacle that they could see. Nobody in this country, no court in this country, ruled the policy unlawful, which was very, very encouraging.
Johnson described the order by the European Human Rights Court to stop the scheduled deportation of a handful of migrants as a weird last-minute hiccup. The United Nations refugee chief has, on the other hand, called it catastrophic. Following the ECHR's decision, British courts now have to clarify whether this practice is lawful.
When it comes to the issue of asylum seekers being exported by his government out of the UK to Rwanda, 1,000 miles away in Africa, that's actually illegal. We have heard this characterization of the issue as illegal from the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, from multitude of international rights.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his government have spent much of this week battling with the EU and rowing with the European Human Rights Tribunal while playing down accusations that they are breaking international law and bow to the base of his party. On Monday, Johnson's Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, revealed the long-awaited Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, a bill which, if passed, would allow the UK government to unilaterally cancel parts of the Brexit deal he struck with the EU in 2019. 2 days later, the EU reacted by launching legal action against the UK for its failure to implement parts of the protocol to date, while the Vice President of the European Commission stated that there is no legal or policy justification whatsoever for unilaterally modifying an international agreement. That is illegal. But the Prime Minister's willingness to have public spats with large international institutions seems typical of him. The Rwandan deportations and the renewed issue of Northern Ireland just seem to be radicalization of British politics, where Johnson tries to stay in power with new crisis.
Well, that's a wrap for this hour's World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
The Kazakh president's visit comes on the heels of various official trips to Iran by the world's high-profile leaders, including President Imam Ali Rahman of Tajikistan and President Serdar Berdimuhamedov of Turkmenistan, for expansion of ties with Tehran in the face of Western unilateralism and the illegal sanctions policy, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Significance of Iran-Kazakhstan Ties. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Kazakhstan's president, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, the head of yet another Central Asian republic to visit Iran over the past 20 days, on Sunday, June 19th, oversaw with his host, President Dr. Seyed Ebrahim Raisi, the signing of at least 9 agreements in various fields between the two large Muslim countries, which trace their roots to the once dominant Persian culture. Today also the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of Kazakhstan continue to share many commonalities, including membership in the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, the Non-Aligned Movement, NAM, and of course, the United Nations Organization, UNO. Although their land borders do not meet, Iran shares marine borders in the world's largest inland sea, the Caspian, with the world's largest landlocked country, Kazakhstan. This indicates the two sides' desire to further develop trade ties in view of Iran's strategic geopolitical location as a land bridge connecting the Asian hinterland with the outside world, thereby providing Kazakhstan and other Central Asian countries the safest and most economical connection to the high seas for export of their products as well as imports of the required goods. Thus, in addition to the Iran-Kazakh bilateral exchanges, what assumes importance for the uninterrupted trade and immunity from U.S. economic terrorism for both the countries is the International North-South Transport Corridor, INSTC, which was operationalized on June 15th by Iran and Russia via the Caspian Sea for transport of cargo from St. Petersburg to Mumbai, India, bypassing the Circus Mediterranean Sea Suez Canal Sea Route. It is a multi-modal connectivity project that is designed to build a 7,200 kilometers long network of ship, rail, and road routes to move freight between Europe, Russia, Iran, India, and Central Asia that greatly reduces the cost and time it takes to transport commodities from Europe to South and Southeast Asia via Russia, Central Asia, and Iran. This is where the visit to Tehran of President Tokayev and his high-ranking delegation gains more significance. Kazakhstan has called on Iran to take necessary measures for the expansion of cooperation between the ports of the two countries on the Caspian Sea, stating that this landlocked Central Asian country is able to send 6 million tons of goods to Iran through railway for export to other countries. Kazakhstan is a major oil and uranium producer, and last year, during a meeting between Dr. Raisi and Tokayev on the sidelines of a SCO summit in Tajikistan, the two sides had agreed to strengthen bilateral relations, including cooperation, to better facilitate rail freight transport to speed up the transit of goods. The Kazakh president's visit comes on the heels of various official trips to Iran by the world's high-profile leaders, including President Imam Ali Rahman of Tajikistan and President Serdar Berdimuhamedov of Turkmenistan, for expansion of ties with Tehran in the face of Western unilateralism and illegal sanctions policy. In this regard, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who granted audience to President Tokayev, cautioned him on the machinations of the West against independent countries, saying that closer cooperation amongst the free world will definitely defeat Washington's devilish plots. Iran has made spectacular progress in various fields, including agricultural machinery, chemical fertilizers, medicine, and industrial products. It also has 120 years of experience in oil extraction and enjoys excellent know-how in various fields of technology. The Kazakh delegation has expressed readiness for cooperation in the sectors of mining as well as the oil, gas, and petrochemical industries. It also welcomed joint work with Iran on various sectors, including home appliances, medical equipment, and medicine. To sum up, trade ties between the two countries are expected to increase manifold in the next few years to the tune of at least $3 billion.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. On this show, we bring reports from all over the world on Zionist attempts to eliminate criticism of its occupation of Palestine. In the US and Canada, the war on solidarity with Palestine is particularly intense. Today, we look at Zionist efforts to suppress free speech and even intimidate public institutions like universities into firing professors who share the majority worldview on the need to liberate Palestine. Later in the show, we'll look at other examples of Zionist pressure on free speech. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi on how Zionists attacked Stephen Salater, which brought his academic career to a premature end.
Stephen Salater was offered a tenured post at the University of Illinois in late 2013 and was scheduled to take it up in August 2014. However, in July 2014, Salater posted many tweets critical of the Zionist killing spree in Gaza, in which over 2,000 people died. A cherry-picked selection of these were brought to the attention of the university by the press and Zionist groups. First attacks came from William Jacobson, a law professor at Cornell University who works closely with Zionist groups such as the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. Within days, the Zionist Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation, which states that among its purposes is supporting the development of Israel, had joined the attack. Rapidly, the university became the focus of a mass Zionist campaign, and it received hundreds of letters from university alumni, students, parents of students, and members of Champaign-Urbana's pro-Israel community, as well as pressure from several large and small donors threatening to remove funding in the future. Emails that Illinois Chancellor Phyllis Wise exchanged on the case, which were later published, though heavily redacted, reportedly show that she was more concerned about a donor who is on the board of the Jewish Federation and Hillel, two Zionist organizations, than she was about the views of academic officials who report to her. Hillel is the campus organization claiming to represent Jewish students, but which is in fact formally Zionist. Of course, accusations of anti-Semitism were bandied about by the Zionists, but Salaita is not in the least bit racist against Jews. In the end, because of this, they had to find something else to sack him for. Salaita explained, "If there's no serious moral or political argument in response to criticism of Israel, then condemn the speaker for various failures of tone and appropriateness. A word becomes more relevant than an array of war crimes." Salaita later won a court case against the university, which also found that the Chancellor, Phyllis Wise, was involved in tampering with evidence in the case by trying to conceal email messages, and she immediately resigned. A settlement was reached in November 2015, which awarded Salaita $600,000 and an additional $275,000 to cover his legal expenses. He did not, however, get his job back. What does this case tell us about the wider climate? First, as Salaita himself unflinchingly put it, Zionist smear campaigns aim to make you destitute. Despite subsequent job offers, also withdrawn, he was unable to secure another job at a university, and he now drives a school bus in Washington, D.C. He remains, however, an active critic of Zionism. Salaita has published a guide on how to handle a Zionist defamation campaign. His Twitter followers have gone from about 2,000 before his sacking to 10,000 in late 2014, rocketing up to more than 55,000 today. He has published two books since the incident in Illinois, and his spirit remains strong.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined by Khaled Barakat. Khaled is a Palestinian-Canadian activist and writer. He's a founder member of the No One Is Illegal organization, which campaigns for the rights of refugees. He was initially deported from the US, then detained in Germany, before being deported and banned from the country for what was described as his rhetoric. Today, he's in a battle to remain in Canada, which has been his and his family's home for around 20 years. And Khaled joins us today from Vancouver, where it's very early in the morning, so we're very grateful to have you here, Khaled, and welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. I mean, there are real parallels, aren't there, in that story that we've just seen on the VT there, with what happened to you, as issues about, you know, concerns about donors to the university. And I think that was a factor in your case, wasn't it, which led to your dismissal from Bristol University.
It was. That was one of the factors. The university had a number of letters from benefactors saying that they would withdraw funds, that they wouldn't give funds that they had previously given, or that they would not give any new funds. And, of course, that was something which they took seriously. It became clear since then that amongst those who had offered to give money and who had previously given money to the university was Gerald Ronson of the Community Security Trust, which was, of course, the organisation which started the campaign to get me fired in the first place. So a very close parallel, I think, and it shows the way in which the tactics used by the lobby, by the Zionist lobby, are replicated all over the world, in America, in the UK, and in other places too.
I mean, Khaled, I wonder if we could ask you to reflect on this case and give us your assessment of the situation in Canada right now.
Thank you for the invitation. I think this smear and racist campaign that we are witnessing in Canada, the goal and the objectives behind it is to divert the attention of what's happening in Canada and what's happening in Palestine. They don't want us to speak about the Israeli daily crimes and atrocities against our people in Palestine, and at the same time, they don't want to see the changes and the developments that it's happening here in Canada. We have a growing Palestinian solidarity movement. The student movement in Canada and the universities have been really achieving victories one after another, especially on the front of boycotting Israel and exposing its racist policies and war crimes against Palestinians in Palestine from the river to the sea. And we also see that, you know, the Canadian pro-Israel lobby is actually weak. They are in the defensive, and they're trying to jump into the offensive by criminalizing the Palestinian people's struggle and the Palestinian resistance. That's really why they're doing this. And we think that it's really important that we also see the growing solidarity movement with Palestine globally. Israel cannot get away with its crimes against the Palestinian people, and they have been doing this for the past 74 years.
Absolutely. I mean, David, let me just ask you about this Hillel organization. I mean, what do you know about this organization, and is there a UK equivalent?
Well, Hillel is a very old, long-standing organization, but it comes out of an even older organization. It comes out of this organization called B'nai B'rith, which also set up the Anti-Defamation League in the US, which is the US equivalent of the Community Security Trust, which I mentioned just a little while ago. So it set up Hillel, and Hillel is a student organization. It's formerly part of the Zionist movement, and they have representatives on campuses right across the US. But the UK equivalent, people won't know this, is the Union of Jewish Students.
I was just thinking that, right? Actually, yeah.
But the formal name of the Union of Jewish Students, when it's registered at Companies House, is the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation.
Interesting.
So we see that this is simply the UK chapter of an international organization, yes, which is itself at the top registered with the World Zionist Organization and is formally part of the Zionist movement. These are the things I've been saying for a long, long
Indeed.
Time, and people sort of look at me askance about this. But, you know, these are clear organizational
Indeed.
Links.
Well, very clear from your answer there, David, and the way in which they've registered as an organization. But Khaled, I mean, you know, you've been targeted in three different countries. I mean, is there something to be said for the idea that Israel, or the Israeli regime, is stalking Palestinians across the planet? It certainly seems that way.
Absolutely. I'm not the only one. I mean, there are so many Palestinian activists and writers and even solidarity activists with Palestine, including some of our Jewish comrades who have been attacked severely by the Zionist movement. And they want to criminalize, again, any solidarity with Palestine. And I just want to say that, you know, when they have this list of organizations like Hamas and the PFLP and other Palestinian resistance organizations and Lebanese resistance, we say that we don't accept this, because this is not just criminalizing an organization, but an entire people. We support the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian and the Lebanese resistance, and we say that publicly. And we are not going to shy away from saying that our struggle is to dismantle this racist regime of Israel. Israel as a state needs to cease to exist, and we need to build an alternative society in Palestine where everyone could live together in peace and harmony and real justice from the river to the sea. I mean, an Israel project as a Western colonization project had failed. It is reaching its peak because they are actually in their peak of strength, and Israel is becoming a total fascist regime that is dangerous to the peace in the region and the world. I think the entire world is watching this and beginning to understand how dangerous Israel is.
I absolutely think that's right, Khaled, and I certainly take your point about anti-Zionist Jewish people being targeted, and you know, many of my friends, anti-Zionist Jews, who were very much targeted by the Zionist lobby. But David, I was struck by the quote there that
the Zionist smear campaign aims to sort of make people destitute. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I mean, that's what they were trying to do to me. They've tried to make me destitute. They've chucked me out of a job, a very well-paying job, I have to say, and into what? Nothing. I was immediately cut off from all salary. Now, the result of that has been that I've come back stronger and harder, and perhaps they regret what they've done because I'm much more of a critic and I have much more time to criticise the movement now than I had then. But that's what they aim to do. They aim to make me and indeed you and many other people destitute, and they want to crush us into the ground. And of course, that's the problem they've got, is that they can't do that because the resistance lives beyond individuals like me or you, and it is based in and grows from the strength of the resistance actually in Palestine. Mm-hmm. So they want us to be destitute, but as Khaled has been saying, they are failing, they are reaching the peak, and so they are lashing out and attempting to destroy us, but their power is tenuous.
No, indeed. I mean, my very real sense is that the resistance is indeed growing, as you say. But Khaled, just very briefly, I mean, what's your impression of the strength and the impact of the solidarity in cases like these?
Actually, we are really overwhelmed with the solidarity, support and the support we are getting. I mean, the pro-Israel lobby is very strong in Canada, and yet they are not getting any kind of support on a public level. Yet we are getting the support from the labor movement, from the student movement, from various different, organizations, and people are actually reacting with establishing initiatives such as the Canadian Legal Center for Palestinian Rights here in Canada and other popular initiatives. When the Zionists attack us,
That's very encouraging to hear, Khaled, and it's so important, I think, and that, we do need to unite, I think, throughout the world, and it's good to hear that solidarity is working in Canada there. But I just have to pause the discussion there for a moment, because I want to just look at this report on Zionist intimidation that was actually used against Khaled Barakat.
Few Israel lobby campaigns of harassment in the West have had the ferocity of the campaign against Palestinian-Canadian writer Khaled Barakat. First deported from the United States, then detained, deported and banned from Germany merely for rhetoric. Today he's in a battle to remain in Canada, where he's lived with his wife for almost two decades. The anti-Palestinian thrust of German government policy is becoming more and more glaring. From banning all demonstrations of support for Palestinians and a vigil for journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, to cleansing Palestinian employees from the German state broadcaster. The German government even forced the resignation of the director of Berlin's Jewish Museum for a social media post sharing an article about Jewish opposition to anti-BDS legislation in Germany. Khaled Barakat is an academic, an activist, and a founding member of the No One Is Illegal organization, which campaigns for the rights of refugees. A series of actions against him by the German government reveal the spite of this campaign. The vindictive crusade began with an event featuring him being shot down in Germany in June 2019. Following that servile move, the German government then detained, deported, and banned him for 4 years, with the Interior Ministry claiming it was in response to his rhetoric. Since then, he's been legally challenging the German state. The campaign against him has even included Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs, Gilad Erdan, who wrote a letter to the EU's Parliament's president demanding Khaled Barakat be banned from speaking there too. This attempt by the temporary entity was unsuccessful. Now Barakat has found himself the target of a coordinated campaign to deport him from Canada, which has been initiated by the Canadian Senate by pro-Israel Senator Leah Houssakos. In the past, Houssakos has publicly celebrated the Nakba and is supported by Israel lobby group B'nai'th B'rith. The target is also to criminalize the Canadian branch of Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, Samidun, which works to support the thousands of Palestinians kidnapped in Israeli dungeons. Take a look at Leah Houssakos slavishly reading from his script about Barakat.
from the United States. He's been barred from Germany. Yet the Trudeau government still allows this individual to remain in Canada, despite Canadian law that forbid any individual with connections to terrorist organizations from entering our country or receiving Canadian citizenship. Why does your government allow him to remain in the country?
Another group working to deport Barakat is the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, which is led by Shimon Fogel, who claims to have established the shared values strategy supported by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Khaled Barakat continues to resist this campaign against his freedom. This as he resists the cleansing of his people from Zionist-occupied Palestine. Solidarity with Khaled Barakat.
Khaled, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, which is led by Shimon Fogel, who claims to have established the shared value strategy supported by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, is working for your deportation, isn't it? What's your opinion on Israel's tactic of using front groups to achieve political objectives?
Yes, these groups work for the interest of Israeli occupation, and they coordinate on a daily basis with the Israeli embassy and Israeli intelligence agencies, and they are saying this publicly themselves. They're not interested in any harmony or peace in Canada. They are interested in working for Israel. They have jobs, and they want to keep their jobs. And because they're losing on the university fronts, on the labor movement, on academia, and, the Israelis are kind of frustrated in Tel Aviv and telling them, you're not doing your job. You have to start, these campaigns against Palestinians and their supporters who are actually, gaining momentum, and their work has been, clarifying the Palestinian struggle objectives and what is the conflict and the real conflict in Palestine. And notice these groups are actually coordinating with each other in the UK, in Australia, in the United States, in Germany, and all the colonialist power are the one who is backing them. Germany just banned Palestinian March for Return in last May. France is trying to dissolve some of the Palestinian solidarity groups. We have been seeing an attack after another against Samidoun because they advocate for the freedom of Palestinian political prisoners. And so it's a battle, and it is not just in Canada, it's globally. And that's because of the nature of the conflict in Palestine. The conflict in Palestine is not just between Palestinians and Israelis. This is a global conflict where the UK responsible, Germany is responsible, France, Canada, UK, every country that supports Israel has a blood on their hands when it comes to this conflict. They are involved in Israeli crimes. When a country like Germany provide nuclear submarines for Israel, when France supports Israeli racism in international arenas, when the United States fully adopt Israel positions and Israeli crimes, including crimes against journalists who have U.S. citizens like Shireen Abu Akhla. When these things happen, the world watches and sees that.
And we covered the horrific murder of Shireen on a previous show. But David, and just on that point, really, I mean, we've covered similar tactics, haven't we, in previous episodes of the show? I mean, and Khaled talked about how these sort of tactics are deployed in other countries around the world. I mean, it's no coincidence, is it? Or is it?
Well, it's not a coincidence, is it? I mean, it's not as if there is a Zionist organization in Canada, one in France, and one in the UK, which accidentally all comes to the same idea at the same time and pursues it. These are coordinated strategies. These organizations, as Khaled says, are coordinated. They coordinate with the embassy in their own countries, and they coordinate with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and previously the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. These are a global, transnational movement. It's called the Zionist movement for a reason. It's one set of organizations with different iterations in different countries. Mm-hmm. So of course they all have the same strategy. Of course, Stephen's case seems similar to my case. Khaled's case seems similar to many of the other cases we've seen. They are all coordinating. And when Khaled says we have to dismantle the Israeli state, well, I would say, yes, we do, but we also have to dismantle the Zionist movement all over the world. The Zionist movement all over the world plays a major material role in the continuation of the Zionist entity in Palestine today. So we have to disaggregate, decolonize, and deconstruct all of these organizations, and they need to cease to exist. And that's a big, big effort, but that's where we're going.
Yeah, indeed. Khaled, you've been deported from both the US and Germany, and you're now under threat of the same in Canada. What's the involvement of the Zionist lobby in the previous two cases?
Well, actually, in the case of the United States, I was barred from entering the United States, and they confiscated my residency. In the case of Germany, I was deported and banned from entering Germany for 4 years. And we have a case in the German courts, and we're fighting back. We actually just won in March 11th. There was a court, and we won that it was illegal for the German police to ban my event when they prevented me from speaking about, Trump deal of the century. And I was invited by Arab and Palestinian community in Berlin. In the case of Canada, I think we're very hasty by asking for the deportation, because I have been a Canadian citizen since 2003. And, if my name was Arnold and I was white with, blue eyes, they would probably not say deport him. But they immediately assume that, I'm probably here on a visa or a temporary, work visa. But I think they're failing on all these fronts, because the attempt to, especially on the case of deportation, I was a co-founder of an organizations and campaigns to fight deportation in Canada and elsewhere, because it is really important that we don't budge to these intimidation campaigns and we don't, give in. And as, David said, and you said that these tactics have been really cheap tactics and exposed, and they really reflect a weakness in the Zionist movement. They used to be more organized and more smart. They are not anymore, really. They're losing, and they are nervous.
Yeah. No, indeed. I was just going to ask you very briefly, Khaled, what you made of the... being banned about your rhetoric, but unfortunately we are running out of time, so we have got the ability to ask you that question. So thank you very much indeed to David and to Khaled for joining us today, and we'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
The US leader is reportedly planning to offer a security pact similar to the Abraham Accords, finalized under his predecessor, to the autocratic regimes in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, says Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute, in an article published under the heading Biden's policy increasingly looks like Trump's West Asia strategy. Stay tuned for more. All the latest headlines about President Joe Biden's July trip to Saudi Arabia focus on a deal to push down gas prices. In reality, he's making a much more sinister and dangerous calculation than most realize. He's reportedly planning to offer the dictators in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, where all but two of the 9/11 terrorists came from, a defense pact that commits American lives to defend their regimes. What could go right? When Biden ran for the White House, he pledged to break with then-President Donald Trump's West Asia policy. Bring U.S. troops home from the West Asia-North Africa region. Renew the Iran nuclear deal. End the war in Yemen and make the Saudis the pariah that they are. But after refusing to take necessary steps to return to the Iran deal, and with rumors abounding that he's about to offer the UAE and Saudi Arabia a defense pact, Biden's policy is increasingly looking like a continuation of Trump's West Asia strategy. Biden isn't just forgiving Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for his direct role in the beheading of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in return for a Saudi promise to pump more oil. As Biden admitted last week, this West Asia trip is about regional security and that of the Zionist regime in particular. Biden told reporters on June 12th, "The commitments from the Saudis don't relate to anything having to do with energy. It happens to be a larger meeting taking place in Saudi Arabia. That's the reason I'm going. And it has to do with the national security for them, for Israelis," unquote.